Hi, it's Lainey here with Sarah, and we are joined by Mina Blair, who has a very interesting story and the reason why she wrote her book. I'm going to pass over to Sarah for the first question. Sarah, go on. I know you've been very much involved in reading this book.
Well, I have, and I have spent a few nights reading this book. And I messaged Mina a couple of nights ago. It must have been about 11 o'clock at night. I'd been reading it for a few hours. And in this message, I think I pulled my heart out, didn't I, Mina?
Yes, you did. Yes, you did, Sarah.
Because it was just such a beautiful book. So please tell me, I mean, I know what the title is, Not for the First Time. Could you please just tell us what brought you to write a book?
Actually, the title is Not for the Last Time.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. No, so Not for the Last Time. Well, it took me actually 10 years to come to the point where I felt I had a book to write. And the story begins with the loss of my youngest daughter. I had two daughters and I lost the youngest one. And it basically set me on a kind of like a, I'd like to say spiritual quest, because I needed to find some answers to some key questions about what happened and how it made me feel. And basically, it took a number of years for me to meet the people that I needed to meet and to travel to the places that I needed to go to just speak with people and learn and basically process everything that had happened. And it was 10 years after the event that I then felt like I kind of had something to say. And then it took me 4 years to actually write it. So it's been a long journey.
So Mina, you had your other daughter and you had family around you. Did they go on that journey with you at the same time, or was this very much you in your own head and your own space kind of journey?
It was very much my own. I mean, I think for people who have suffered loss, the thing that happens is that people react really differently, even within family units. And so my oldest daughter reacted in her way, and Francesca's father reacted in his way, and we were all very different, and we all took different amounts of time to deal with the grief and did it in our different ways. So it's my story. It's about what I went through to do it. Yeah.
I think it's important just to say that, I think to the listeners as well, that actually we do all grieve differently, and how you grieve and the length of time you grieve is absolutely fine. It's right for you, isn't it? So I think it's important that we sort of say that as well.
So Mina.
Yeah, I think so.
So my question is, you decided to embark on this journey, and this journey took you overseas. You went to Uganda, you went to Bali. So do tell me, what was happening in Uganda and what made you go as far as that?
Yes, that was quite interesting. The connection there was that in my corporate days, so this was before I lost Francesca, I had a fairly serious, pretty big corporate job in London, and I spent some time with the senior executives in that role, and the wife of one of the executives, she had got involved in an educational charity in Uganda. And I knew about that through talking to the chap that I traveled with on business. And I got interested in it and I spoke to her about it. And when she explained how they were supporting the various schools and orphanages in Uganda, I wanted to help. So I said, oh, I'll make a monthly donation. And then after a while, she said to me, well, why don't you actually go there? Why don't you follow the money and see what your money is being spent on? And and I actually thought, gosh, yeah. I mean, this was 4 years after I lost Francesca, and I thought, why not? It just sounded like something that I wanted to do. As soon as she said it, I was like, oh yeah, okay, that sounds really cool. So I put it to, you know, my family, and they were like, yeah, definitely, let's go together. So my daughter and my then new partner, we went off, and it was an amazing experience. I mean, I don't think anything really prepares you for the first time when you travel to that kind of part of the world, mm-hmm. and you see how people live, and you encounter, yes, there is terrible poverty and so on, but what surprises you is the joy and the gratitude and the beauty of it all, the people and how they approach their lives and their spirituality also. And it really opened up my eyes to not only accepting what had happened to me, but to also give me some perspective. Because I think when bad things happen to you, it is so tempting, isn't it, to just kind of feel sorry for yourself and go into pity and so on. But then when you go to a place like Africa where death and life, I mean, these are just like really normal things, you know. It's child loss in particular, I have to say, when I was visiting, you know, the various schools and things. And it was very grounding and reassuring and comforting, if I can describe it that way.
You mentioned in your book, and I absolutely love these words, it was an instant sensory overload and culture shock. Tell us about that. What made you say that, make that statement?
In a lot of third world countries, there is a lot of like busyness, there is a lot of people, and driving through, say, for example, a city like Kampala, and then just along the roads and in the villages and in the towns as well, there are people that congregate on the roads, on the streets, and there's a real sense of life. And I think what people aren't aware of here, perhaps, is that we get in our cars, we go to the shop, we go into the shop, we do our shopping, and then we come back into our cars, and then we drive to the house. And you can do all of that without actually having a single conversation with anyone. Mm-hmm. In Africa, there's like life is teeming everywhere. So you've got chatting, you've got music coming at you. The colors are really vivid. The way that the women dress in particular, lots of colorful, you know, you're not too poor to wear something that's lovely with a pattern and colors in it, you know, and the Africans very much like that, the color. And then of course the smell and the heat and the sounds. And it's just, yeah, it's overwhelming. We're a bit cocooned here, I have to say, in the West, in that sort of way. We're quite separate. Mm-hmm. And when you enter into something like that, you're like, oh, whoa, wow, this is just all your senses, everything is just happening. And equally, when you then go back to, say, the UK, I get something called reverse culture shock. I get, yeah. It's like all the noise goes down. Everybody's sort of separate. And I miss that life, that sort of vibrancy, you know, it's very interesting.
How did they welcome you? Like, did you find a lot of people to talk to? Did you get involved with a lot of people and did you integrate with them? How did that go?
Yes, so the first trip that we made was very much as guests, and just having visits to the various projects that the charity was supporting. When I came back from that and reflected on how welcoming we were, because I mean they are very grateful for the help and the support, obviously, but I felt like there could be more that we could offer than just money. And so my partner, who is medically trained, I said to him, is there a way that we can kind of do something different for the charity as well as just give money? And so we offered to go out there and do health checks and just do a general sort of, I suppose like a recce, just to see what the hygiene and health situation was like in the schools and offer support and advice. And so that's what we did. So we went out to Uganda several times with kind of like a job to do, and that felt much more appropriate and helpful. And they were very, very interested and happy with that, because really, you know, people in those sorts of countries need. They want knowledge. They need your knowledge. It's not just the cash. You know, they want to be able to do things themselves. Yeah. And so it was kind of like a lot like an empowering thing that we wanted to do. So we gave them the framework for making changes, but then they could action it themselves, you know.
Amazing.
There was something in your book as well, and you really went into detail about this, how they offered you food and how kind they were to you. And what you said was the less people had, the more that they had to give. And you use this synergy. The circle of life was real here, not a Disney movie. Tell us about that.
Well, this is part of the eye-opening sort of awakening piece of the experience. People are very grounded and very real in places like that. So they will be very generous and they will be open, because I think what's behind it is that for them in their lives, if you have a day where you have a roof over your head or a meal to eat and you're not sick from AIDS or you're not sick from malaria, then that's a really good day. You know, you're not going to complain if you've got those three things. And so therefore, when you enter into like an orphanage or a school, they will then want to share that joy with you, right? So they will offer you the gratitude and the big smile, and it's completely genuine. It comes straight from the heart. They are saying, this is a great day, because they're alive and the kids are at school and everything is okay that day. And it makes you then think, gosh, yeah, well, if those things are ticked, then it is a great day, isn't it? And the fact that maybe you run out of mobile phone battery or something is not a big deal. And so what I'm saying there is that it really helps you focus on the really important things and not sort of the things that we can think of are annoying. These are really important things that we should be grateful for. And with their openness and their kindness, because they were just glad to be there that day.
So I guess that kind of puts everything into perspective, doesn't it, in a strange sort of way. A lot of things, it puts a lot of things into perspective.
I think it does, and it certainly did for me. Because I think, as I said earlier, you know, we're so tempted here to be pulled into being dissatisfied, to not feeling fulfilled. We get distracted with the things that aren't right. We focus on the things that we don't have rather than the things that we have. And when you go to a place like Africa, you just don't even dare think those things. You know, when you're talking to someone who's telling you their story that their parents died of AIDS or something like that, and they're just so grateful that they even got to the orphanage, because they are one of the lucky ones, because there'll be a whole bunch of other kids in the village or somewhere else that have all died and didn't actually get this amazing opportunity to be in an orphanage. Mm-hmm. And when somebody's talking to you like that, you're thinking, wow, okay, so the good news is you're in an orphanage. Now, when you use that word here, it instills immediate despair and pity, doesn't it? It's like, oh, this is a terrible mm-hmm. thing. In Africa, boy, you're really lucky. Mm-hmm. And so that's the learning. That's the reminding.
How do you take that with you every day? Like, can you take that with you every day? Do you use it on a daily basis? Because I know the human brain sort of has a way of just making everything normal again. And forgetting is probably a strong word, but you normalize, you know, the experiences that you have. How have you used it? Have you managed to use it?
It is very hard, you're quite right, because it's easy to be more aware when you're in the situation in that space, and then when you come back into the culture, into your sort of normal life, you fall into the usual traps of feeling sorry for yourself or not being satisfied. And I do try. Finding joy shouldn't be hard, but interestingly, it can be, and I do lean into joy more now than I used to, and I just remind myself. So, for example, I really enjoy bird watching, and I really enjoy walking with my dog. And so, when I am doing activities that I really enjoy, then I stay with that feeling. So I don't then like take the opportunity to talk on the mobile phone when I'm walking. I'm just in the space of walking and enjoying the nature and mm-hmm. looking at the birds around me. So I think it takes discipline mm-hmm. actually and sort of effort to actually do that, which sounds kind of crazy, doesn't it? Well, sounds kind of weird.
Mindfulness has come from, because we do find it difficult. So the whole mindfulness that is now very popular is exactly about that, isn't it? It's about enjoying what's in the moment and living in the now. And there's lots and lots of stuff, isn't there, about sort of gratitude and how you should journal your gratitude because it makes you happier and feel better. So, and all of this stuff you've been doing and learnt it from real life experiences, you know, in traveling. So it's really interesting to hear, actually.
I read with interest that you got a puppy and you were saying that it was a bit of a nightmare, but you said the unexpected upside of having this puppy was actually meeting people and the social aspects of it. You also said you could talk to people, complete strangers, without feeling weird.
Yeah, you know what, this is so funny, but I'm actually quite you know, a self-contained person, I have to say. So I'm not the person who will do the big chat when I go out, especially if there are strangers. I think there are people who love that sort of thing. So, for example, at a cocktail party, I'm not the one working the room. Definitely not. That's not me. I'm the one that is like kind of more against the wall and sort of, okay, I'll just talk to this one person. But the thing about the dog is that it brings you out of yourself, because even if you're not talking to someone, people will come up to you with their dog. So whether you like it or not, you're having a conversation, you're having an interaction as people come towards you and they'll say, oh, what a lovely dog, you know, isn't it a nice day, you know, blah, blah. And this took some getting used to for me to start with. And actually, eventually, I really enjoyed it. And now I'm one of those people, you know, that if you walk past me with your dog, I'm like, morning, how are you? You know, that's kind of me. And I kind of chuckle a little bit to myself every time I do it, because that's so not who I was. But that is part of this joy that I was talking about earlier. Mm. Yeah, the dog, it gives you permission. I mean, if I walked around, you know, in these commons on my own and just started talking to people, yeah, I think there might be a bit of, what's that person doing? But with the dog, you see, everybody's immediately comfortable. It's fabulous.
It is. It's almost as though it's an extension of yourself, isn't it? Because I have two dogs and I can't take both dogs out at one time. It has to be one dog. But you're right. It does give you permission to chat to anyone. And like you say, whether they've got a dog or not, your dog is kind of an extension of you, isn't it?
Yeah. And he's like super friendly too. So again, there's just no way I can control this situation. He likes to go and say hi and check out the other person's dog. And oh yeah, no, absolutely. He's a part of me for sure.
So tell us, you then went on to Bali, didn't you? In 2017, why did you go to Bali?
Well, I had been practicing yoga for a number of years up to that point, for about 6 years, and I found yoga because I had a really sore back, and I had tried a number of different treatments, and they just really didn't help. And then I found myself in the yoga class of the local village hall, and it was just a huge eye-opener. I was in such bad shape. I can't tell you. I could hardly do anything. I couldn't believe it. And I just loved it. And I thought, right, I'm going to commit to yoga and sort myself out, because this is just no good. I couldn't bend forward, backward, sideways. I couldn't hold up my weight. I mean, it was sad, very, very sad. And then I got to know the yoga teacher, and she was lovely. I was very lucky in finding her, because she was also very interested in not just the physical practice of yoga, but also the spiritual side of it and books. And so that's how I got into the Eastern philosophies. And then after a few years, so this would have been now, so 6 years, she suggested that I'd made quite a bit of progress. And she was the one that said, you know, you really ought to consider becoming a teacher yourself? And I thought, no, oh my goodness, no. The thought just sent, you know, I started to shake just thinking about it. And she just said, no, just consider it, because you really are enjoying this, and you're able to understand yoga at all these different levels. You should, you know, have a think. And so I did think about it and started looking around for, you know, different yoga schools, of which there are 1,000. So it was, I did a lot of due diligence and to pick just the right one. And I thought to myself, you know what, I'll just go and do it. And I wanted to immerse myself completely. So I wanted to go away from my home and be in somewhere really different for a whole month and just literally eat, breathe, sleep yoga, have the full experience. And I thought to myself, well, I don't have to commit to teaching afterwards. For me, it felt more like a personal challenge that I really needed to do. And so that's how I embarked on that particular journey. I went to Bali and I immersed myself. And, I mean, all manner of stuff came out, including a lot more grief for losing Francesca. And I learned, obviously, how to teach yoga, but also a lot about myself. Because I think the best way, or in some ways the nicest way to face your stuff, is to go on solo travels. Wow. It really tests you, and you have to look after yourself, and you have to learn how to trust people and make good judgments. And it's just so, it just expands your mind, it expands everything. And when I then got back, I had the qualification then, and when I got back, again, I was quite relaxed about the whole teaching thing. And my good friend, also called Sarah, she said to me, when are you going to start to teach? Because I've been really wanting to get back to yoga. And I was like, oh, no, you know, I'm not sure. And she was like, oh, go on. You know, I think it would be really good. I'm sure there'll be people. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I then did some private teaching during that summer of 2017. And then I thought, actually, you know, why not just throw it out there, throw it out into the universe and see what happens. So I found a local village hall and put up some flyers and stuff. And of course, Sarah came, and she came with a few friends, and it just grew from there. It literally, I discovered I had an inner teacher after all, and I absolutely love teaching, interestingly. Mind you, I don't know why I'm even saying this in such a surprising way. I come from a whole family of teachers, by the way. I just never thought that it was me, but it is.
Sorry.
I'm just going to grab this question, but have your family adopted yoga as well, or any of your philosophies? Has it all rubbed off on your daughter and your partner?
Yeah, it did, actually. Yes, my daughter, in fact, did her own yoga teacher qualification not that long ago. And she set up her own business in Bristol. She lives in Bristol. She set up her own business teaching yoga in schools because she's a qualified teacher, secondary school teacher, but she decided to leave that and do yoga instead. And she had done so well from nothing. She had created this very successful business, and then sadly COVID happened and her business ended kind of overnight. So she's gone back into now teaching proper, as it were. But yes, so she's a yogi. Not so much my partner. longer journey there.
What I just wanted to go back to a passage in your book, and I believe it's when you were in Bali, and you wrote in there, for the first time I think ever, I had a real sense of contentment, not happiness, but contentment. And then you go on to say that the two are not the same. Do you know, I always thought they were the same. So tell us, how are they different?
Contentment comes from within. It's a feeling that you sort of generate inside yourself. So happiness, when you think about the way people think of happiness and talk about happiness, they will say things like, you know, he makes me happy, or, you know, my job makes me happy. My dog makes me happy. It's always like out there. So there's like an object out there that makes you happy. So something else or someone is giving you happiness. When you feel content, that comes from inside yourself. You give that yourself, where you are genuinely happy and glad with what you've got, not with what you might have or what might or what someone might give you, but just with your lot. You are genuinely satisfied with your lot, and that's what contentment is.
There was one other passage that I have to ask you about, because I found it quite deep, quite meaningful, and I believe this was, it is, you mentioned it when you're in Africa, and you said, "My broken heart had found solace and healing in the heart of Africa." Why was that?
Well, I think that goes back to the people and the country and the beauty, and reminding me of the things that really are important. And even though I'd suffered this loss that was just profound for me, I think the healing in Africa was to sort of not only just acknowledge the loss, yes, that is a sad thing, but then along with death, there is life also. And so the turning point for me in Uganda was making that very subtle shift from what was no longer to what is there, and the more, what more can there then be? So it was kind of like not looking behind me, but turning my attention more forward, and all the good things that I not only had already, but then could have more of going forward.
And it's quite hard work to keep that up, I'd imagine, is it?
Yeah, because the challenges keep on coming. And in the book, I write about other things that happened. It wasn't just the child loss. That's sort of like the beginning of the book. But I also discovered along the way that my husband has Asperger's. And so that presented me with a whole new challenge of understanding what that was about, and having to make adjustments and dealing with, you know, a certain sense of disappointment, and, you know, and then having to turn that into a learning opportunity, which it definitely has been. So I think life is like this, doesn't it? It gives you, it knocks on your door regularly, if you think of it that way. And each time it does, you have the choice between, oh, okay, I'll have a little look at that, or ignoring it. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but when I ignore these knocks on the door, they just come back a little louder. Maybe it's just me, but, you know, that's the way it is.
That suppression, isn't it? If you keep suppressing and suppressing and suppressing, you eventually erupt, because your body can't take it. You can't keep it in there. And actually, yoga is a fantastic medium to release some of that as well, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, speaking of, you know, what is it that, you know, keeps you joyful? Definitely yoga. Practicing yoga and teaching yoga are, that's probably my mainstay source of joy, I'd say. Yeah. No matter how bad I feel, either physically or spiritually or emotionally, when I practice yoga, I just feel better afterwards. I mean, that is just how it is. It's an enormous gift, and I love doing it. Yeah.
Well, I'm fascinated by your story. I really am. There is just one last point I want to cover. And I know Lainey is going to understand this, because I will often throw questions at her, sometimes even in interviews live. But this isn't one for Lainey. This is for you. And it's just a statement you made. And I think it again was when you were in Bali. You said, "Most people do not listen with the intent to understand. They listen with the intent to reply." Now, I know I have done that so many times. Talk us through that concept.
Well, you know, it's interesting, but listening is actually quite hard. And I remember kind of learning about this when I went through my counseling training. That was after I left my corporate job and before I went onto the yoga path. I was a counselor, and I worked with young people in particular for about 5 years. And the first thing you are taught in a counseling training, well, a good counseling course, is how to listen. Now, normally, everybody thinks that they can, or that they do all the time, but actually you don't. And to really listen to someone and to hear what is behind the words is not quite the same as hearing like the words. And what tends to happen in our very busy, kind of stressy life is that, you know, we want to get our point across, don't we? We want to say what we have to say and so on. But often we're maybe not so good about hearing what's coming towards us. And I think when you think about it, it is very easy when somebody's starting to talk to you, you then start to formulate what your thoughts about that particular thing is, isn't it? And rather than hearing out that person fully, you will just wait for that person to stop talking and then you go straight in with what you want to say. It's a very subtle thing, this. It's very, very subtle. But obviously in a counseling room, you have to be super aware of this. I then take that into other parts of my life. And it's incredibly useful to know how to listen. But that's what I meant about that, yeah.
Yes. And you know that I advocate that, Sarah. I do a lot of coaching with people as well. And I teach people particularly that actually listen to hear, don't listen to speak. Because as you've just described it, you know, we often are formulating the questions in our head. But I think that's kind of why probably Sarah and I like doing this with real people like you, because listening to your story is always a pleasure. And you know, you have been an amazing guest and I've really liked listening to you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And I mean, I again, the whole listening thing, I love it too, because I do a podcast, a weekly podcast as well. And I like talking to people and hearing their stories. I think we have a lot of things that we can share and give to each other. So absolutely, I love it too. And I've really enjoyed being on the show with you.
Thank you. Well, we've really loved having you, haven't we, Sarah?
And reading your book, absolutely fascinating. And I think what's the nicest part for me is being able to talk to you and pose my questions to you. Because I find when you read a book, sometimes you're left at the end of that book with a bit of an anticlimax, because there's a lot of questions that are going on in your head, but you've got no one to ask them, have you? And that's, I don't know, have you ever picked that up, Lainey, when you've read a book?
That's a really good point, actually. I hadn't thought about that. When you're reading a book and now you've actually got the author in front of you and you can talk about their book and find out more about it.
Because if, you know, a famous author, you can't suddenly ring up this author and say, oh, by the way, chapter 2, word whatever so-and-so, what do you mean by that? And you can't do that. So for me, this evening has just been wonderful because I've met the real author and I've been able to ask my questions. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. I've had a lot of fun and I enjoy, you know, sharing the stories and just talking to you this evening. It's brought back all these happy memories and all the things that you know, I've gone through and come through. And I think ultimately this is what the book is really about. You know, it's about empowering yourself. It's about finding the joy. Try and find joy in everything.
And
that's the thing.
And
so give us the name of the... Oh, you're going to say the same thing, aren't you?
I'm going to say exactly the same thing, not for the last time. But you know I said right at the beginning, not for the first time. I don't know why I said that, because it's written down in front of me. So that's Not for the Last Time by Mina Blair.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
What we'll do is we'll just stop the recording and then we can just have a quick chat. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. Andy, could you come and stop the recording for me? I don't know if he can hear me.
Where are you from, Nina? Have you got a slight accent somewhere there?
Yeah, I'm from Oslo. I'm from Norway.
Okay. It was sort of, for a minute, I thought, is it slightly Australian or?
No, I mean, I'm from Norway, but my father's American. But I've lived here for a long, long time now, since I was a teenager. So, yeah, maybe there's a bit of, somebody described my accent as mid-Atlantic once. And I was really?
Yeah. And also,
is that a place?
The other thing I wanted to ask you, which I didn't ask on the interview because I wasn't too sure.
You finished then?
Yeah, we finished. So you can stop it. We're just having a chat.